Good morning. 6 and a half after 9 o'clock, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, last week, President Bush earned the praise of Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold. Write that down in your diary because it hasn't happened very often, and here's why. Feingold liked something that Bush did. President Bush vetoed the Water Resources Development Act of 2007, the so-called Water Bill. The president's veto message said that the bill lacked fiscal discipline, pointed out that a $15 billion House bill went into negotiations with a $14 billion bill from the Senate, and instead of splitting the difference, the bill that emerged was what's called a Washington Compromise that costs over $23 billion. We're going to talk about the water bill this hour on the Ideas Network, and to help us figure this out and kind of see what's in it, and there are two sides to every story, and there are some major projects that would involve shoring up the levees in New Orleans and other areas of Louisiana that were hard hit by Hurricane Katrina. There are always projects that need to be done, harbor dredging and so forth, but there are certainly a lot of earmarks in this bill. And it's expected that President Bush's veto will not stand. The House and Senate are expected to override the veto because there's just too much in this that really shows up in the districts of various elected representatives in Congress. So to help us discuss this bill, we are joined by Steve Ellis, Vice President for Programs of the organization Taxpayers for Common Sense. He joins us by phone. Good morning, Mr. Ellis.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to talk with us about this. You know, when I started to research this, I looked at a copy of H.R. 1495, which is the Water Resources Development Act of 2007, and I quickly realized that if I was going to try to read this this thing all the way through, I was going to need excessive amounts of caffeine. It's a huge piece of legislation, and there's literally something in there for everyone.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there's basically about 900 different projects that are scattered throughout the bill, each going back to, obviously, you know, as one person said, you know, there's a project or 10 in there for everybody.
Well, clearly there are some projects that need to be done. I mean, we need harbors dredged so that ships can continue to go in and out of them. There's certainly still some needs in Louisiana and along the Gulf Coast for repairs to things that were damaged when Hurricane Katrina came through. Not everything in this bill is a piece of pork.
No, absolutely, and that's absolutely correct. And I don't think anybody, not our group, not the president, not Senator Feingold, thinks that there aren't worthwhile projects, some pearls amongst this pork within this bill, but. At the end of the day, you look at it, and you've got $23 billion, billion with a B, dollars worth of projects in here that are authorized. These are essentially green-lighted projects for the Corps to build. But just like anybody else, the Corps needs the money to build the projects. Well, the Corps only gets about $2 billion in construction funding every year. And they have a $58 billion backlog of work that's already been greenlighted. So now we're adding $23 billion to $58 billion, and they're only getting $2 billion in construction funding every year. So something's got to give here. And what ends up happening is that the politically powerful projects, the ones who are backed by lawmakers who really have the juice to deliver taxpayer dollars, are the ones that rise to the top, rather than having some sort of system where we're prioritizing projects. And that was one of the key reforms that Senator Feingold requested on the floor and worked hard to try to get on the floor, but ultimately failed.
Now, for those who maybe were sleeping during their high school civics class or who, like me, often have trouble understanding all the various machinations of Congress, this was an authorization bill. There wasn't actually any money attached to it. No dollars were spent. And they were just saying, okay, these are some projects, Army Corps of Engineers, we want you to do, and here's how much we think it'll cost. And by the way, we're not giving you any money right now.
Right. I mean, the way one lawmaker put it to me a few years back is that an authorization is a license to hunt. And so you don't necessarily bag any taxpayer dollars, but it puts you into the game to then try to get the taxpayer dollars. But that doesn't mean that an authorization is worthless or doesn't have some impact in the process. And certainly, if you go and you look at many lawmakers, members of Congress's press releases, they're touting about all these projects that they're bringing home. Now, some of those will never see the light of day. They've had the highest point in their existence just by being authorized. But what this has done is it adds to the pipeline of all of these projects. And as you can imagine, I mean, to you or to me or to your listeners, $2 billion, that's a lot of money. I think I could do a lot with $2 billion. The core, it's a little bit more limited when you start building these projects. And what has happened is because there's so much pent-up demand, they spread the money further and thinner over more projects, which means that it takes longer to construct them, which means they cost more, and it delays the actual benefits coming back from the project.
Well, I would think, too, that one of the dangers would be that in order to try to spread the money further, corners get cut.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Corners get cut. Projects don't get constructed in a timely fashion. And, you know, I mean, essentially, and then when you add to that the political element where it isn't necessarily even the most meritorious projects that rise to the top. It happens to be the ones that are in Mississippi because the minority whip and the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee both happen to be from their senators from Mississippi, namely Trent Lott and Thad Cochran. Or, you know, it happens to be going to West Virginia because the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate is from West Virginia, or along those lines. And so those are really critical elements that undercut our ability to deliver the important and the critical infrastructure projects that our country needs.
Now, both houses of Congress passed this bill. The original bill was passed in the House on April 19th, 2007, and then the Senate passed its version on May 16th, 2007. And the House bill originally was somewhere around $15 billion, and then the Senate bill was slightly less than that. And so they went into conference committee, and what came out was a bill that had a $23 billion price tag on it. So basically, if you add 15 and 14, you get 29, so they managed to find $5 billion worth of projects they weren't going to authorize. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it was more that there were some big-ticket projects that were in both bills, so they didn't have to duplicate it. But all the other projects, they just basically... Everybody, you know, there was no give or take. It was just take, which, you know, you mentioned your civics class. It's certainly not the way that you remember how the conference and hammering out the differences between the two chambers was envisioned in our civics class or in Schoolhouse Rock when we used to watch, you know, I'm Just a Bill on Capitol Hill back on the cartoons.
Boy, that takes me back. Let me do something that I neglected to do at the top of the program. Give the phone numbers and invite people to join us in our discussion with their questions or comments. If you've been following this at all, let us know what you think. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is a toll-free number that you can use to reach this program. If you're in Milwaukee, we'd appreciate it if you would use this number, 227-2050. We're talking about the Water Resources Development Act with Steve Ellis, who's Vice President for Programs of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Now, according to the website GovTrack, which is a great place to look if you want to know what the status is of any piece of legislation in either the House or the Senate, this bill is going to cost $24 per American over the 2008-2012 period. Is that assuming that they actually appropriate the money that it would take to build the projects in this bill, you know?
You know, I don't know. I'd have to kind of do the math there, but that sounds probably like that's what they're talking about, yes.
The you know, when you put it that way, well, $24 a piece, you know, I probably waste more every week on soda than that. You know, what's the big deal? So why should this matter so much?
Well, I mean it's a zero-sum
game. It is $23 billion, but if you look at the entire federal budget, $23 billion is, well, even Senator Dirksen, were he still alive, would probably have to say that wasn't a lot of money.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I think, actually, it's kind of funny that Senator Dirksen, you know, the real phrase that he said was, you know, a million here, a million there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. In Washington these days, people always talk about it, that he said a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. But it just shows how times have changed. But, no, it's you got to look at it a little bit beyond than just, well, yeah, I'd be willing to spend that amount of money or Congress would be willing to spend that amount of money. You have to look at it in the context of the overall federal budget. And yes, we have a $3 trillion federal budget. We have about, we out of that, though, about $2.1 trillion of that is non-discretionary spending. It's Social Security, Medicare, military retirement benefits, that type of thing. The other remaining $900 million is what you call discretionary spending. Well, that would be a big chunk of discretionary spending, particularly if you look at where the core is right now, where they've got a $5 billion annual budget as an agency, and they get about $2 billion within that five to build projects. And so it would be an enormous burden to try to deal with this, along with all the existing projects that they're currently dealing with. And so to just add more projects, to add more fuel to the fire without actually creating a system to prioritize the projects like Senator Feingold and McCain and others demanded, you really have set up a system for failure. And what I would point to on this is that one of the lessons learned from Hurricane Katrina, and that was right after it happened, right after the levees failed, there were a lot of people who said, see, we didn't spend enough money. Well, in reality, we sharpened our pencils and we looked at what had happened in Louisiana. And in the five preceding fiscal years to the hurricane, Louisiana had received $1.9 billion, more money in Corps of Engineers funding, more money than any other state in the union. California was a distant second at less than $1.4 billion. And so it wasn't a case. Could they have gotten a couple hundred million more? Sure. But really what it came down to is the money wasn't going to the critical projects or to critical new projects. It was going to things like the J. Bennett Johnston Waterway in northwest Louisiana. The J. Bennett Johnston Waterway, formerly known as the Red River, is a navigation canal or navigation waterway that has virtually no barge traffic. And so here you have a boondoggle in northwest Louisiana that's sucking up billions of dollars, and instead of getting the money to towards storm damage protection and things like that that you really needed in New Orleans and coastal Louisiana.
Well, and here again, you know, you've got some, we mentioned this at the top of the program, there's some really worthwhile programs or projects in this bill. For example, one of the things that I noticed was there was a project contained in there that was designed to help keep the Asian carp out of Lake Michigan. Maybe people in California or Louisiana or Florida don't understand how important that is, but I'll tell you what, if the Asian carp ever gets into Lake Michigan, the Great Lakes fishery is basically dead. That would be just a tremendous environmental disaster if that fish gets out of the Chicago River and into Lake Michigan. Well, that's part of it, but there's no guarantee that that project will ever get done. If I'm reading what you're saying correctly,
right? No, absolutely. I mean, it's still going to have to compete for dollars, and it may be because there are projects that are far less worthy, but with a lot more political muscle, that end up getting funded or moved to the front, or siphoning off some of those dollars that would have been going to that. So the project would still go forward, but it would be limping ahead, and you wouldn't have a fully functional barrier as fast as you would if you prioritized that because of the economic impacts of the Asian carp getting into the Great Lakes fishery.
We're at a time where we need to take a break, so let's do that. And when we come back, we'll take some calls, and we have some questions that have been posed that people want me to ask. So I will take care of that too. We're talking about the Water Resources Development Act of 2007 and what it means with Steve Ellis, Vice President for Programs at Taxpayers for Common Sense. And you can join us as well by calling 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 922 on this Tuesday morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Here's what's coming up a little bit later today on the Ideas Network. Americans love their gangster movies. Just look at last week's weekend's box office winner, American Gangster. After two on Talk of the Nation, Gangster Love, why we can't get enough of mobsters in the movies. After two on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the Water Resources Development Act, and our guest is Steve Ellis, Vice President for Programs, Taxpayers for Common Sense. One of the things that is clear about this bill is that there are a lot of what are called earmarks, pet projects for individual legislators contained in this bill. Now, when Congressman Dave Obie, who's from Wisconsin, became the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, he said they were going to cut back on earmarks. And that has happened in some bills. This bill, clearly not. Do you have an idea of what Congressman Obie's involvement was in this particular bill?
I don't think that he had much involvement aside from if he submitted any projects or supported any projects for his congressional district. This bill was written in the House of Representatives in the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee.
That would have been Jim Oberstar's. That would have been Jim Oberstar's committee, I believe.
Absolutely, that's correct. And then in the Senate, it was the Environment and Public Works Committee, which is Senator Boxer from California is the chairman of that. And so he would have had, Chairman Obie would have had limited involvement in the bill, just mostly the involvement of being a member of Congress, obviously a little bit different member of Congress in the fact that he's quite powerful and can reward or punish, but nevertheless still that sort of role. And yes, we have noticed that in the spending bills, in the appropriations bills that Chairman Obie has control of, they have held down the number of earmarks. They have halved the number of earmarks, but we're right about where the rubber meets the road, where the Senate has not done as well as the House, and they're about to come out with their conference bills, and so we'll have to see how that shakes out, and they're just getting to that right now.
Okay, we have some callers who have been waiting to join us on this topic, so let's go first to Jim in Eau Claire. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
My central point here that I always get frustrated with when I'm talking or hearing about presidential vetoes and how he is trying to be fiscally responsible is how we can just simply ignore all the money that's being spent in Iraq.
Well, no, I don't think you can ignore all the money that's being spent in Iraq, and I think that that's something that is a major challenge and a major frustration. I mean, as an organization, one of the things that we did even before the war began was we were concerned that there wasn't a lot of talk about what the cost would be. I mean, I don't think that's the reason you decide to go to war or not to go to war. It's just simply cost, but we actually did our own estimate of what the cost would be because we were frustrated the administration was not proposing that. And, you know, our number, unfortunately, has turned out to be way low, but nevertheless, it was much bigger than anybody was contemplating at the time. And that is certainly a major crimp in our finances and is a major challenge for the country going forward.
So,
Jim, thanks for the call. Do you have a follow-up?
No, I just wanted to put that point out there.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call. One of the things that as I was reading, doing my homework for in preparation for this program, that I ran into, the democratically controlled Congress now seems to have restored the pay-as-you-go philosophy in terms of if you're going to pass some legislation that has real money attached to it, you have to that money has to actually exist. pretty much. And that was something that we had gotten away from for a while, and it certainly isn't true about spending related to the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Bills like this one seem to go against that in some respects, because nobody has any idea where the money's coming from to finance the projects in this bill, do they?
No, they don't. And they're going to end up competing with other projects to try to get into the baseline budget. And, you know, certainly it would be interesting if there was some requirement that projects that are no longer justified, you know, as I mentioned, there's an existing $58 billion backlog of projects that you know, they would deauthorize large numbers of those projects to actually move these up onto the list. And I think that having some sort of system where we're clearing things off of the list instead of just adding more to the course honeydew list, if you would be useful and be helpful and help concentrate Congress's mind towards the most important projects. And I think that really comes back to some extent, not to get too far away from the PAYGO, but to back to some of the things that Senator Feingold really fought for on the floor, which was establishing a system of prioritization for the core projects that makes basically saying, let's look at all the flood damage reduction, storm damage reduction projects, and we'll try to come up with some priorities and you know, gross priorities where we move certain things to the top, and the same thing for navigation projects and the same thing for environmental restoration projects, and so that we then inform Congress with what are the national priorities here. Congress can decide to take something from the bottom of the list and spend it, move it up to the top, but at least we'll have had that information and that knowledge when we're making that decision, rather than simply a black box budgeting approach.
800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion from just about anywhere. In Milwaukee, please use 227-2050, 227-2050. We're talking about the Water Resources Development Act of 2007, a $23 billion authorization bill, which adds to what the Army Corps of Engineers is going to need to work on. Even if, let's just say that we decided we were going to go ahead and get all these things done, and so we take the $58 billion in backlogs and the $23 billion, and Congress just says, you know what, we're just going to borrow all this money, fine, we'll just finance all these projects and let's just get them all done. Would the Army Corps of Engineers be able to do all of these projects in a time frame when they could be done for the amount of money that was originally authorized?
No, the Corps doesn't have that kind of capacity. I mean, to ramp up to that level would be very, very, well, I mean, it would just be impossible for the agency. I mean, to take a $5 billion agency with a $2 billion construction budget and then, you know, increase their budget by hundreds of percent and expect them to be effectively managing these projects. And then even beyond that, you know, I mean, if you start talking about you've got to look at what are the economics of this. You know, what are the sunk costs of the opportunity costs of spending that money. I mean, what else are we not doing because we're going to borrow and spend all this money on these projects? And clearly, some of these are boondoggles. They're not even meritorious projects. Certainly, don't benefit the national economy. And so, it's something that we would be foolish to be wasting our money on that when we have so many other precious demands on our resources.
Well, let's talk about some of those boondoggles. I think a lot of people have heard of the so-called Bridge to Nowhere. That's a bridge project up in Alaska, which is contained in this bill.
Not in the Water Resource Development Act. It's from the same committee. It was the Transportation Infrastructure Committee that brought you the Bridge to Nowhere. But it was not in this bill. It was in the Highway Bill in 2005, the Bridge to Nowhere. But certainly, there are other projects, some that are in your neighborhood that we've been highly critical of, like the lock expansion project on the Upper Miss and the Illinois Rivers, which is a little bit further down south. It's mostly in Missouri, Iowa, and Illinois. But it's a project that was the Corps chief economist for the project, for the Corps, blew the whistle on the project back in 2000. A colonel and two generals were reprimanded for manipulating the data to try to justify this multi-billion dollar lock project. And here we are 7 years later, and the exact same project, the seven new locks that was under criticism at that time, is exactly what the Corps is recommending and Congress is authorizing in this bill. And at the same time, the major economic justification for the project, which was increased traffic and delays on the Upper Mississippi River, are not materializing because traffic is declining. And so, I mean, and that's just one example in this bill. There are others. There's a case of where there's a $200 million navigation project in Iberia, Louisiana, western part of Louisiana, closer to the Texas border. And essentially, this is a project when the Corps first did their analysis, they were finding that it was going to return 30 to 50 cents on the dollar. And what happened was in a 2005 supplemental appropriations bill, the senator from Louisiana, Senator Landrieu, directed the Corps to count the numbers totally differently. And even when they did that, they still came back with about a $1.03 return for every dollar invested in this navigation project in Iberia. So you have a state, Louisiana, that has tremendous challenges, tremendous needs in hurricane and storm damage protection, and yet you have a boondoggle, a navigation boondoggle, that's being forced upon the country and upon the nation's taxpayers by Senator Landrieu. So, I mean, it doesn't have the bridge to nowhere, but it's got its share of boondoggles.
I think it may have a study related to that bridge. I think there was a study on the impact of navigation for the proposed bridge.
You're absolutely correct. There is the bridge was to connect Gravina Island and Ketchikan, and there was a study on the navigational impacts of that bridge. And actually, it was of the Kinnick Arm Bridge, which there was two actual bridges to nowhere in there. One was to connect Anchorage over the Kinnick Arm, and the other one was the Gravina Island to Ketchikan.
Let's take a call this time. We'll go to Paul in New Berlin. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to offer a suggestion as far as things that are not being done, actions that are not being done that could save the taxpayers' money and still improve the water quality of our those precious resources. And that, namely, is currently there is the Metropolitan Sewage District of Milwaukee is taking water from west of the divide out of the deep aquifer and shallow aquifer various places, especially New Berlin. And that water is from the deep aquifer is a different chemical makeup and has to be softened with hundreds of thousands of tons of salt and radionuclides of the waste from that process and dumping that into Lake Michigan. So it's degrading the water quality of the lakes. And they're also taking water out of the shallow aquifer, which provides the base flow to the tributaries to the Great Lakes. So these are both environmentally incorrect things to be doing. And one action that would actually make money for the save money for the taxpayers and make money for the taxpayers is if the water from the lake went to the area that is served currently by the sewage district. So you'd have water from the lake and return to the lake, but do not expand the sewers any further because that there is a consumptive loss from the Great Lakes. So the idea being, if you're going to take water from the ground, return it to the ground. Don't send it off to the lakes with extra salts and everything else. And if you're going to take water from the lake, return it to the lake. That would save taxpayers' money. It's a very common sense solution, I believe.
Paul, thanks for that. I'm not sure if there was a project in the Water Resources Development Act that related to that. I know that there were some things in the Sheboygan and areas south along the shores of Lake Michigan, but I don't know that there was anything related to that in the bill.
Yeah,
but clearly there are some environmental issues that are addressed in the bill, or at least that's what the language suggests. And as we said earlier, there are a lot of projects that would really have some tremendous benefit, which may not get done simply because they aren't backed by someone powerful enough.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, certainly the process of funding, it's based more on political muscle than it is actually on project merit. And I think that the caller, Paul, made some good points about, really looking at water use and where the water is coming from, where the water is going to. It's getting more in the east to be sort of how things have long been looked at in the west, which is water flows uphill to money. And those challenges, maybe not so much as acute in Wisconsin, but certainly as you look at some of the issues around Atlanta and, in the southeast where they're still in a massive drought, are going to be huge challenges going forward in this century. And those are things that I think that the country has fallen short of, at least being taking a long view and far-sighted in a lot of our water projects. And those are areas that, we as an organization have pointed at that can be more cost-effective to the taxpayers in the future, to try to figure out how to, one, make sure that people are paying the appropriate amount for water services, and then, meaning like they really know what the cost is of treating and supply. And then secondly, really looking very critically at this idea of moving water over large expanses, just like this caller mentioned, but the interbasin transfer issues, because you end up, just like you have cross subsidies, where you can have cross subsidies in the water bank as well.
Let's talk a little bit about beach replenishment, because that was something that came up, that popped up in a number of searches that I did when I started looking into the Water Resources Development Act, and I was actually pretty amazed at some of the things in there, and in particular, the success of certain areas in getting millions of dollars to put sand back on beaches. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, the whole idea of beach replenishment, it's kind of a nice sounding term. They also say re-nourishment. But essentially you're just pumping sand onto the beach to replace sand that is eroded away. And it makes you think of, not to get too mythological, but it makes you think of Sisyphus, the guy who is cursed to roll a stone or to push a stone up a hill, only to have it roll down again and then push it back up. And that's essentially what we're doing on the beaches. We mine sand, we dredge sand from other places, we pump it onto a beach, and then it erodes away, and we find more sand, and we pump it back on. And the taxpayer, the federal taxpayer, the people in Wisconsin are picking up 65% of the cost of doing this for beach properties, which in many cases are home to very wealthy landowners. And it's been documented that the economic benefits of these projects are generally in the local area. It's tourism, it's increased property values to these homes, and essentially we're still picking up the lion's share of the tab, even though the lion's share of the benefit is going to the local area and not to the nation as a whole. And this is a huge growth industry for the Corps and for lobbyists. There's a lot of lobbyists that are engaged in chasing these dollars. And as you look at the issues around potential, whatever amount it is, but potential sea level rise over this next century, you're looking at an area where there's a little bit of rise goes a long way, because you're talking about a very low slope area and a very low lying areas. And those are going to be all challenges going forward. And to some extent, we are helping people stay in harm's way rather than helping them out when we do these beach replenishment projects.
Well, there's a certain amount of beach erosion that's caused by storms,
mm-hmm.
and there's been a lot of money spent, for example, along the Florida coast to repair damage from hurricanes and so forth. But there's going to be a certain amount of beach erosion that's just going to occur, just because that's what happens when waves continue to crash. And if the sea level is rising, you're just going to be losing beach. But we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on this. According to what I read, there are some environmental problems with taking sand from one area and dumping it on a beach, because not all sand is alike, is it?
Right. Well, yeah. John, one thing is that storms have been going on since before we were around, and beaches have always been there. Now, they may move. They may shift. It may a beach may accrete in this place and erode in another place. But at the end of the day, the only reason why we talk about the beaches disappearing in certain locations is because we've drawn the proverbial line of sand, line in the sand, which is where the houses are, and somebody bought the house and they had 100 yards of beach, and now they only have 10, and all of a sudden they're talking about the beach eroding. Well, really, it's just moved. And it's only because we've fixed a point in geography that we're saying this is where a beach should be that's occurring. But then secondly, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are both environmental and economic aesthetic issues with sand. I mean, if you're talking about, there are communities in the panhandle of Florida where Pensacola in that area, that are famous for their white sand beaches. Well, the Corps can't just go anywhere and dredge up sand and pump it on there because the grain size will be different. It'll have different characteristics, and it may not be that pure white sand that the tourists are looking for and what they've bragged about there. And then even beyond that, there are questions about how it affects turtles for reproduction, the grain size, and then also even that sort of thing affects the erosion rates in areas and how fast they erode and how they erode. It even gets to surfers. The Surf Rider Foundation is one of the biggest critics and opponents of a lot of beach replenishment projects, and it's because it destroys this, you know, generally they destroy the sandbar, and there is no break and there is no surf involved in these areas. And that's not a small, I mean, people think of, Endless Summer or Gidget when they think of surfing, but it's actually a major recreation and economic industry in a lot of these areas.
800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion. We're talking about the Water Resources Development Act of 2007, which passed by overwhelming margins in both the House and Senate. After coming out of the conference committee, it passed by overwhelming margins in both houses initially, and again when the compromise, quote unquote, bill came before the two houses, there was another overwhelming vote, and this time it's expected that a number of Republicans will break ranks with the president and will vote to override this veto. I don't think Russ Feingold will be one of them, and that creates that's a sort of a man bites dog kind of story. Anyway, 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion. 227-2050, please, if you are calling us from Milwaukee. My guest is Steve Ellis, who is Vice President for Programs of Taxpayers for Common Sense. I want to talk about the political aspects of this. We've talked about, you know, some individual projects and things like this, but here's a case where the president has he didn't take out the veto pen once when the Republicans had control of Congress, and this is either the fifth or sixth item that he's vetoed since the Democrats reclaimed control of Congress in the last election. And I want to talk about the political significance of what's going to be a large number of Republicans in both houses who are expected to break ranks with the president over this issue, and what that might mean in terms of future legislation that your organization may be looking at. How significant will this be politically, assuming that Congress follows through and overrides President Bush's veto?
And what you just outlined there, John. I mean, one is he did veto one veto when the in the 109th Congress when the Republicans still had control. It was one of his two stem cells vetoes.
That's correct.
This is the fifth veto of his presidency. He did stem cells twice. He did S-CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and he did one supplemental appropriations bill. But I think the thing that also tells me is that, okay, Congress couldn't vote to override stem cells, S-CHIP, or the supplemental, but when it comes to water pork, they're all there, sign me up, and they're ready to override the president's veto. And it just sort of shows to some extent where I think that their Congress priorities lie on these issues. Now, as an organization, we've been calling for presidential veto since way back in the beginning years of him being in office, whether it's the Farm Bill in 2002, the Transportation Bill, the Highway Bill that had the Bridge to Nowhere, and many other spending bills along the way, we've been very much calling for his stepping forward and vetoing that legislation, which he failed to do. And it's something that we've been critical of, and we made jokes about it, about whether, you know, that the veto pen was in a secure, undisclosed location with the vice president, or whether it was behind glass in case of emergency, or lost in the couch cushions in the Oval Office. But at the end of the day, he didn't veto any legislation in his first term in office. And like I said, the only one was the one stem cells during the first Congress and the second term when the Republicans still had power. I think that, yeah, there's going to be the votes on WERDA bills, these water project bills, have always been incredibly lopsided towards voting for. It was interesting to me that, and it's only because I've watched a lot of these over the years, they didn't even get 400. They didn't get, normally they get, I've seen votes on WERDA in the House that have 5 votes against. This time, there were more like 30 votes against. I think it was a little less than that, maybe 20 votes against. But there were less than 400 votes for the bill. And in the Senate, there were only 18 or 80-some-odd votes for the bill, which, by word of numbers, those are off. Those are down, which I think is interesting. And it'll be interesting to see. I'm not saying that the veto will be sustained, but this is the president trying to establish his fiscal bona fides. And this is also, you can't ignore this in the run-up to the debate on the spending bills, which are coming in the next few days here in Congress, where they're going to start sending conference reports to the president, and he's promised to veto those.
By the way, for Wisconsin listeners, all 9 of Wisconsin's members of the House of Representatives voted in favor of this bill, and I'm going to look up the Senate vote on that just to see. I'm assuming that Senator Feingold, Senator Feingold and Senator Cole both voted in favor of this bill.
But not the conference report. Senator Feingold voted against the conference report in August or in end of July.
Okay, I didn't. I clicked on the wrong link. I'm sorry. I have too many things in front of me on the screen.
No, I understand. And they certainly don't make it too easy to
No way. No kidding. I have a master's degree, and
power.
I was having trouble. Let's take another call quickly before we go to our break, and we'll go to Ann in Madison, who's been holding for a few moments. Ann, good morning. Thanks for calling us.
Hi. I wondered first how much scientific advice Congress and the president get in deciding which projects to approve. For instance, in Wisconsin, a lot of what DNR has been doing in recent years is removing dams that were once believed to be a godsend, you know, for various economic interests, and they've turned out to not be such a good idea after all. So there's a, you know, total waste of money, like we've talked about diversion of rivers and so forth. And second, I wondered what is in the bill that might build up the Mississippi Gulf of Mexico Delta again at New Orleans. Kathleen had a guest about when Katrina first happened, a geologist or hydrogeologist or somebody like that, who said that if that delta, you know, it New Orleans is the biggest port, I think, in the United States, and if that delta had still been there instead of been eroded, the damage Katrina did wouldn't have been nearly as devastating.
Well, on your first question, ma'am, there was most of the scientific analysis of these projects are done at the agency. So at the Army Corps of Engineers, as they start making their way forward through the process. Now, some environmental groups and others have been critical of some of that analysis and some of that information, and sometimes the Corps is a political animal. I've always pointed out that they and Congress sort of grew up together as far as delivering projects, and there's been a lot of acrimony, actually, between the executive branch and the legislative branch over the Corps, and often the Corps it's somewhat in defiance of our Constitution, seems to see itself more as a animal of the legislative branch and of their congressional patrons rather than actually the executive branch. And I can look back to Harold Ickes, who was Secretary of Interior under Harry Truman, saying that there were no more lawless agency in the entire government than the Corps of Engineers, and it continues on. But then also, kind of on your second question about Louisiana, that is one of the greater challenges facing this country, at least in a water resources realm, in the coming decades. The coast of Louisiana is losing a football field size of wetlands every 30 minutes. And as opposed to maybe some areas where you can argue that it's strictly an environmental issue, which of course has some economic consequences, there are direct economic consequences in New Orleans, in Louisiana. It's not just New Orleans, but it's also the oil and gas infrastructure, the shipping infrastructure. It's not the largest port in the country, but it's certainly in the top five. And it is something that is going to be a real challenge. There are provisions in this bill that would start the process or help continue the process of figuring out how to try to restore coastal Louisiana. But there are also projects that I think are sort of caught in the past that are either A, wasting money, like I mentioned the Port of Iberia project earlier that is a boondoggle, $200 million, and then there are also projects, there's almost $1 billion for a storm protection project called Morganza to the Gulf that is old thinking, pre-Katrina thinking, that isn't really going to provide the amount of protection that is necessary and not in enough areas, and really is something that is moving forward just because it's ready to go forward, when in reality we could do a lot better. And I think that the other thing not to lose in this is that the president's veto and our support of the veto and Senator Feingold's support of the veto, I'm sure, is not to say never do a Water Resources Development Act. It's go back to the drawing board, put this thing on a diet, come out with something that's a heck of a lot leaner, that's got stronger teeth in the reforms, and that's a much more forward-thinking piece of legislation, and then, you know, we'll take our ball and go home, and, Senator Feingold will be able to vote for that, and the president will sign it.
We're going to go to a break. I just wanted to correct one piece of misinformation I passed along in the vote for the conference report, which is the compromise bill that came out. Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin voted nay. The other eight members of the delegation voted yes. This is a discussion about the Water Resource Development Act, and you can join our discussion at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:56. Coming up after 10 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, according to a recent study, the number of same-sex couples in the United States has quadrupled in the last 17 years. I'll be talking about where they're living and the challenges some gay elderly are facing. That's coming up in just a few minutes from right now here on the Ideas Network. We're trying to wrap up our discussion of the Water Resources Development Act, and our guest this hour has been Steve Ellis, Vice President for Programs, Taxpayers for Common Sense. We have a couple of minutes, about 2 minutes left before we have to really get out of here. And I want to make sure we didn't leave anything on the table that we should have talked about in terms of this act. Now, in technical terms, the president has vetoed it. It is nearly certain that both the House and Senate will override that veto. And then what happens?
Well, and then the bill will, it becomes law. If both the House and the Senate override the veto, then the bill becomes law without the president's signature. I think that is a good statement. Even if the bill becomes law without the president's signature, there's somewhat of a black mark against the legislation, and something that shows that there were problems with it, and that it just tarnishes the bill a little bit, which I think is well deserved for this piece of legislation, and it certainly set the bar for future presidents looking at this and for future Congresses. I don't think it makes everything hunky-dory for this piece of legislation, and I certainly applaud the president for his veto. I applaud Senator Feingold for his remarks and his willing to vote to sustain the veto. And I think that that's a smart position and one that this bill is well deserved.
Well, Senator Feingold has certainly earned his reputation as a contrarian. He doesn't do always what you expect him to, and he's clearly got some principles that he refuses to violate. We got about 20 seconds left now. Is there any hope that we'll revisit the Army Corps of Engineers and get some meaningful reform?
I think that yes. I mean, the bottom line is the reason, the underlying reasons for the reforms are still there. We're still going to have the problems, and Katrina really brought a lot of those issues home about the lack of prioritization, about the need for independent peer review, about the need to modernize the Corps' approaches. And unfortunately, life keeps teaching us lessons until we actually learn them. And I think that we're going to continue to learn lessons about the need for reform and the need to modernize and improve the Corps of Engineers and what they do for the American taxpayers.
Thank you very much. Steve Ellis, Vice President for Programs Taxpayers for Common Sense. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.